calmly now, stealthily and evenly, like an army of parachuting invaders. Ezra returned to his chair and picked up a book. Three times the silence was torn by a page turning. Then a balmy effervescence flooded Alice's insides, and her skin began to feel as though it were vibrating.
Whoa.
Ezra checked his watch. Is it working?
Mm-hmm.
He called Obstbaum. He took her in a cab to Mount Sinai. He arranged for Zingoni's to deliver groceries to her apartment twice a week for 6 weeks. He took pictures of her in her cast.
I love you, purred Alice.
You love Vicodin is what you love. We're out of film. He went to the closet.
What else have you got in there?
You don't want to know.
Yes, I do.
More girls, tied up.
How many?
Three.
What are their names?
Katie.
No, said Alice. Let me guess. Katie and... Emily? Is Emily in there?
Yep.
And Miranda?
That's right.
Those girls are incorrigible.
Incorrigible, he repeated, as though she had made up the word. Her cast was heavy. Heavier, it seemed, when she had nothing else on. Alice turned over onto her stomach and stretched like a three-legged cat. Then she pulled herself up, arched her back, her sides, rolled her head around on her neck, and grinned wickedly.
What?
Walking toward him on her knees.
Let's do something awful.
It knocked him back a little.
Mary Alice, that's the smartest thing you've ever said.
They sat in the last row so as not to be conspicuous, also so that he could get up and stretch his back if he needed to, but he didn't. It was a Saturday matinee, and the movie theater was swarming with small children. When an especially excited one spilled popcorn on Ezra's sleeve, Alice worried he might be having second thoughts. But then Harpo lit his cigar with a blowtorch, and Groucho passed his hat through the mirror, and it was Ezra's laugh, head back and unthrottled, that could be heard above everyone else's. At the end, when Fredonia declares war on Sylvania, and the brothers waggle their hips singing, "All God's chillin's got guns," Ezra drew a plastic water pistol from his pocket and gave Alice a furtive squirt in the ribs.
"We're going to war,"
they sang, walking back down Broadway, past the colored lights and tempera snowdrifts and Christmas trees bound up tightly to look like cypresses. "Heidi, heidi, 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 ho." At the sturgeon shop, crowding with the others up to the sneeze-proof glass, they gazed down on the smoked fish, pickled tongue, and tarama salata, as if at newborns in a maternity ward. Alice pointed at a cheese labeled Firm Smear and whistled primly. When it was his turn, Ezra raised a finger and ordered,
"Two pieces of gefilte fish, some horseradish, half a pound of kippered salmon, and, what the hell, 2 ounces of your finest paddlefish roe for Miss Eileen here."
"Oops," said Alice. Ezra turned to look at her calmly, then tutting and shaking his head.
"I'm sorry, darling. You're not Eileen."
Caller ID blocked.
"Hello? Good evening. May I speak to Miranda, please?"
"Miranda isn't here."
"Where is she?"
"In jail."
"Is Emily there?"
"Emily's in jail, too."
"What for?"
"You don't want to know."
"What about...
Katie?"
"That's right, Katie."
"Catherine."
"She's here. Want to speak to her?" "Please."
"Hello?"
"Hi, Katie. It's Mr. Zipperstein from school."
"Oh, hiya, Mr. Zipperstein."
"Hiya. How are you?"
"Fine."
"Good. Listen, I'm calling to ask whether you'd like to study at my house one night this week."
"Okay."
"You'd like that?"
"Sure."
"Tomorrow?"
"Shoot, I can't do tomorrow. I have a piano lesson tomorrow."
"Thursday?"
"Art club."
What about afterward, after art club?
Thursday's my night to set the table.
I spoke to your mom about that. She said you can set the table twice on Friday instead.
Okay.
Thursday at 6:30 then?
Sure.
Which one is this again?
Katie.
Stay out of jail, Katie.
I will, Mr. Zipperstein.
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 Good girl. My sweet little whorish, Nora. I did as you told me, you dirty little girl, and pulled myself off twice when I read your letter. Yes, now I can remember that night when I fucked you for so long backwards. You had an arse full of farts that night, darling, and I fucked them out of you. Big fat fellows, long windy ones, quick little merry cracks, and a lot of tiny little naughty farties ending in a long gush from your hole. It is wonderful to fuck a farting woman when every fuck drives one out of her. I think I would know Nora's fart anywhere.
That's disgusting, said Alice.
He lowered the book and gave her a dully affronted look. Sweetly, Alice slithered under the covers and scrambled around there until he came like a weak water bubbler. They dozed. When his watch beeped 8, Alice groaned and whispered,
I have to go.
Ezra nodded warmly, softly, not opening his eyes. Sitting at the table to buckle her shoes.
You know that homeless man, the one who stands in front of Zabar's and wears 100 coats even in summer?
Mm-hmm.
Did you buy him all those coats?
Yep.
And do you think he went crazy before he became homeless or the other way around?
Ezra thought about this. Don't sentimentalize him.
What do you mean?
Don't pity him. Don't over-empathize with him. He's fine. In the bathroom, she rinsed her mouth, brushed her hair, and tied a dental floss bow tie around the dildo standing on the vanity. Then she left, coming down the steps of her own building.
Good morning, dear. You look pretty today. Tell me, do you have a boyfriend?
Not yet, Anna. Not yet.
For the holidays, he went out to his island. Alice took the train up to see her mother, whom she would decide it was impossible not to sentimentalize, and returned on New Year's Eve to attend a colleague's dinner party. The eggplant was tough and the risotto too salty, and afterward everyone got drunk on cheap brut and wrote stupid things on Alice's cast. Any resolutions? She asked the boy, slumped beside her. Someone had told her he had a book of poems coming out in the spring.
Sure, he replied, straightening a leg and running a hand through his long, spiraling hair. Quality and quantity.
In Union Square, a girl in gold sequins threw up in the subway trough while her friends took pictures and laughed. When Ezra came back, they opened champagne, real champagne, and ate Bulgarian caviar from Murray's. He also brought her a box of jelly donuts from the Shelter Island Bake Shop and an 8-CD box set of Great Romantic Standards entitled They're Playing Our Song.
Any you don't know?
My heart stood still.
Ezra nodded, leaned back in his chair, and took a deep breath.
I took one look at you, that's all I meant to do, and then my heart stood still.
September song?
Another deep breath.
For it's a long, long while from May to December, but the days grow short when you reach September.
He had a good voice, but he distorted it for levity's sake. Shyly, Alice smiled down at her donut. Ezra chuckled softly and rubbed his jaw.
You have jelly just here, he said.
Ezra, she said a moment later, passing their plates to him in the kitchen. I don't think I can do it tonight.
Neither can I, sweetheart. I just want to lie down with you.
On the bed, she struggled to find a place for her cast.
When does that come off?
Wednesday morning.
Why don't you come here afterward and I'll give you some lunch, okay?
Okay, thank you.
How's work?
What?
I said, how's work, darling? Oh, well, you know, it's not what I want to be doing for the rest of my life, but it's fine.
What do you want to be doing for the rest of your life?
I don't know.
She laughed softly. Live in Europe? Do they pay you well?
For my age?
You have a lot of responsibility?
Sure. And my immediate higher-up is going on maternity leave next month, so I'll be doing some of her job soon.
How old is she?
Mid-30s, I guess.
Do you want children?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Not now.
Ezra nodded. My darling Eileen got to be 40 and wanted a baby with me. I didn't want to lose her, so I thought about it very seriously, and I came close to doing it. I'm glad as hell I didn't.
What happened?
We split up, which was very hard, and it took a while, but she found someone else. Edwin Wu. And now they have little Kyle and Olivia Wu, who are 4 and 6, and pure enchantment.
They drifted toward sleep, even though he hadn't done his 100 things. Alice sniffed.
What?
My grandmother, the one who likes baseball, her name is Elaine. And when my grandfather, who was an alcoholic, proposed to her, he was so drunk that he said, "Will you marry me, Eileen?"
Alice laughed.
Ezra's arm around her stiffened.
Oh, Mary Alice. Sweet Mary Alice, I want you to win. Do you know?
Alice lifted her head to look at him. Why wouldn't I?
He ran a hand over his eyes, fingers trembling. I'm afraid some man is going to come along and fuck you up.
The night before his birthday, they shared a praline tart and watched the president announce the invasion.
In this conflict, America faces an enemy who has no regard for conventions of war or rules of morality. We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. We have no ambition in Iraq except to remove a threat and to restore control of that country to its people.
This man is so stupid, said Alice, shaking her head.
This is going to kill me, said Ezra, forking the tart.
She gave him a cord for his reading glasses. He gave her another $1,000 to spend at Searle. The following evening, a friend was going to throw him a party to which Alice was not invited.
Is this the same friend who calls me the kid?
Ezra tried not to smile.
Hasn't he ever heard of a kid's table?
Sweetheart, you don't want to be there. I don't want to be there. Besides, you're the one who doesn't want people to know about us. You're the one who doesn't want to wind up on page 6.
His back was better. His book was going well. He wanted Chinese food.
One order of shrimp with lobster sauce, one order of broccoli with cashews, one order of hacked chicken, and... Mary Alice, do you want a beer? 2 bottles of Qingdao. Yes, no, I think it was 1 shrimp, 1 broccoli, 1 hacked chicken, and... That's right, 2 Tsing Sao. Tsing Tao, yes. Exactly, Qingdao.
Helplessly, he clapped a hand to his forehead and laughed. The voice on the other end became indignant.
No, he said. I'm laughing at the way I talk.
He hung up.
40 minutes. What should we do?
Take a Vicodin?
We've already done that.
Alice sighed and flopped backward onto the bed.
Oh, if only there were a baseball game on.
Oh, you're going to pay for that, little bitch.
He was telling her about a beautiful Palestinian journalist who'd been at the party and wanted to interview him when Alice frowned and lifted her head from his chest.
Uh-oh.
What?
Your heart is doing something funny.
What's funny about it?
Shh.
He raised his eyebrows at her and waited. Alice lifted her head again.
It's doing 3 beats, then a pause, 4 beats, then a pause, 3 beats, then a pause.
Are you sure?
I think so.
Maybe I should call Pransky.
Who's Pransky? The best heart guy in New York?
Smartass, would you get me the phone, please, and my little black notebook there? Pransky agreed to see him the following morning and detected nothing amiss, but decided he should be fitted with a defibrillator anyway. This time, while she was waiting to hear, Alice was at work interviewing her boss's daughter's babysitter about an internship.
So how do you know Roger?
He lives next to my uncle in East Hampton.
And what does your uncle do?
He's in, like, securities.
But you'd rather work in publishing?
The girl shrugged.
I like to read.
Who do you like to read?
Caller ID blocked.
Do you want me to go outside?
No, that's okay.
Okay, Ann Beattie and...
Caller ID blocked.
Are you sure?
Don't worry. Ann Beattie and...
Julia Glass? I just finished 3 Junes and it was so good.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
The girl turned to watch a window washer rappel down the building across the street. Several seconds went by and then she sniffed and lifted an arm laden with bangles to scratch her nose.
Beep.
Oh, said the girl, turning back. And I love Ezra Blazer.
What does it feel like?
Like I've got a cigarette lighter in my chest.
It looks like you've got a cigarette lighter in your chest.
Sitting on the toilet, he watched attentively as she wrung out a washcloth and dabbed at his stitches that ended only an inch from his quintuple bypass scar. The spiky black thread wound in and out of his skin like barbed wire.
Are you sure this is a good idea? Alice asked. Getting it wet so bzzzt,
he said, making her jump. On the eve of the first Boston Yankees game, they went to a restaurant called Il Baccio, but which Ezra referred to as the meatball.
The food here is shit, he said cheerfully, opening his menu. But we can't spend all our time in that little room, do you know?
Under the table, he passed her a bottle of hand sanitizer.
I'll have the salmon, Alice said to the waiter, still rubbing her hands.
And I'll have the spaghetti vongole without the vongole. And a Diet Coke, and... Mary Alice, would you like a glass of wine? A glass of white wine, please, for the lady.
A woman in a fuchsia pantsuit approached their booth, ecstatically wringing her hands.
I'm so sorry. I'm embarrassing my husband, but I just had to tell you how much your books have meant to us.
Thank you.
I've got 2 of them on my nightstand right now.
Good.
And you, said the woman, turning to Alice, are very pretty.
Thank you, said Alice.
When she'd left, they sat looking at each other shyly. Ezra rested his elbows on the table. He massaged his hands.
So, Mary Alice, I've been thinking,
the waiter came with their drinks,
that maybe you would like to visit me out in the country this summer.
Really?
If you'd like to.
Of course I'd like to.
He nodded.
You could take the train out to Greenport one Friday after work and then catch the ferry, and Cleet or I will pick you up.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you.
Or you could take a Friday off.
That sounds wonderful. I will.
He nodded again, already seeming to weary of the idea.
But listen, darling, we'll be out there alone for the most part, but there is Cleet and a few others who come around to mow the lawn and whatnot, so I suggest we take the precaution of giving you an alias.
What?
A different name.
I know what an alias is, but why?
Because everyone's a gossip, you know? So we'll call you something else while you're there, and if anyone asks, we'll say you're helping me with some research. And that way, if anyone talks, which of course they will, you won't have to worry about it getting back to work.
Are you serious?
Deadly serious.
Okay. Did you have a name in mind?
He leaned back and folded his hands on the table.
Samantha Bargeman.
Alice laughed so suddenly she had to put down her wine.
And where, she said, did you get that name?
I made it up.
He wiped his hands on his napkin and pulled a business card from the pocket of his shirt. Samantha Bargeman.
editorial and research assistant to Ezra Blazer.
But there's no number on it. What kind of business card doesn't have a number on it?
Sweetheart, you don't want anyone to actually call you.
I know, but for credibility's sake, who's going to believe this is really my card?
Unfazed, he sat back to make room for his spaghetti. He picked up his fork.
Fine, laughed Alice. Did you... When were you...
Maybe in July. Maybe 4th of July weekend. We'll see.
That night, in addition to the rest of the cards, 200 cards printed on butter-colored cardstock and packed tightly into a heather-gray box, he gave her 6 green peaches, a Vermont country store catalog, from which he said she should order some walnettos, plus whatever else she wanted, and charge it to his account. 15 $100 bills wrapped in a notebook-lined piece of paper on which he'd written in red marker, "You know where to go with this."
This week, the United States Congress passed historic legislation to strengthen and modernize Medicare. Under the House and Senate bills, American seniors would, for the first time in Medicare's 38-year history, receive prescription drug coverage. We're taking action because Medicare has not kept up with the advances of modern medicine. The program was designed in the 1960s, a time when hospital stays were common and drug therapies were rare. Now drugs and other treatments can reduce hospital stays while dramatically improving the quality of care. Because Medicare does not provide coverage to pay for these drugs, many seniors have to pay for prescriptions out of pocket, which often forces them to make the difficult choice of paying for medicine or meeting other expenses. In January, I submitted to Congress a framework for Medicare reform that insisted on giving seniors access to prescription drug coverage and offering more choices under Medicare. The centerpiece of this approach is choice. Seniors should be allowed to choose the healthcare plans that suit their needs. When healthcare plans compete for their business, seniors will have better, more affordable options for their health coverage. Members of Congress and other federal employees already have the ability to choose among healthcare plans. If choice is good enough for lawmakers, it is good enough for American seniors.
Oh, shut up, muttered Alice, getting up to change the station before resuming cutting the tags off her new clothing from Searle.
At her door, a shave and a haircut, 2 bits. It was Anna, wearing a misbuttoned robe and tremulously extending a jar of sauerkraut.
Dear, can you open this?
There you go.
Thank you. What's your name?
Alice.
That's a pretty name. Are you married?
Nope.
I thought I heard someone. Do you have a boyfriend?
No boyfriend, I'm afraid. In addition to the walnettos, Alice put a check mark next to coconut watermelon slices, Mary Jane's, Turkish taffy, and Toy Army Men gummy candy. A salute to your sweet tooth. Then she got into bed and fell asleep with the radio on, Camus listing off her knees and the pen she'd used to underline certain passages blotting her pajama sleeve with ink.
I love you, Cormory said quietly.
Malin pulled the bowl of chilled fruit toward him. He said nothing.
Because, Cormory went on, when I was very young, very foolish, and very much alone, you paid attention to me, and, without seeming to, you opened for me the door to everything I love in the world.
Her back hurt. Her breasts were swollen. At work, she snapped at the new girl for unloading the office dishwasher too slowly. From under her bathroom sink, she pulled out a pink plastic clamshell graying with dust. 2, read the last blister no longer containing a pill. White tells your body you're pregnant. Blue says just kidding. 3 years earlier, 6 weeks of this had made her weepy and irascible to the point of lunacy, and she'd quit. But she was older now. Older and more alert to the probability of hormonal ambush. This time she'd be ready for the hysterical thoughts and outthink them. So, 1 white pill tonight, 1 white pill tomorrow, 1 white pill on Friday,
plus a fourth on Saturday after lunch. That, she reckoned, should get her through the weekend blood-free. Caller ID blocked. Hello?
All packed?
Just about.
What time's your train?
9:12.
You won't believe this, but I'm rereading David Copperfield for my book, and four lines down on page 112, I've just come across the word bargeman.
No.
Yes, listen to this. He informed me that his father was a bargeman and walked in a black velvet headdress in the Lord Mayor's show. He also informed me that our principal associate would be another boy whom he introduced by the, to me, extraordinary name of Mealy Potatoes. That's what I'm going to call you from now on, Mary Alice. Mealy Potatoes.
Good.
Can you imagine that I should read bargeman the night before you come? How often does one see that word?
Hardly ever.
Hardly ever, that's right.
Alice took a sip of Luxardo.
Fucky fuck? If you want.
No, I guess we shouldn't. It's late. She waited.
Darling?
What?
Tell me something.
Okay.
Do you ever think this isn't good for you?
On the contrary, Alice said a little too loudly. I think it's very good for me. Ezra laughed softly.
You're a funny girl, Mary Alice.
I'm sure there are funnier.
You're probably right.
Anyway, she said, you make me happy.
Oh, sweetheart, you make me happy, too.
Light shimmered in the trees, whose leaves, when the wind ran through them, sighed like the gods after a long and boozy lunch. The air was balmy and brackish, and here and there carried a whiff of pine sap bubbling under the sun. Alice dove into water that he kept heated to a temperature approaching that of blood, and after torpedoing half a length, surfaced to settle into 30 laps of an unhurried breaststroke, legs frog-like, hands coming almost together before swiveling away again and again, always the right reaching forward to touch down between the insects that crawled along the flagstone edge, always the left folding close to wipe her nose before the next lap commenced. Some days it could even seem to her that she was making a kind of progress with this routine, as though the laps she swam were not the self-same distance, traveled and untraveled over and over, but lengths laid like pipe, end to end, and that would someday deliver her to a destination as far away as their great sum. Coming almost together and then pulling apart, her hands looked to her like the hands of someone once tempted by prayer, but who had since renounced it for other means of mollifying herself. Someone learned, someone liberal, someone literate, someone enlightened. The pump house hummed. In the evenings, they listened to Music for a Weekend to Remember, which was like Jonathan, only cornier, and took their plates out to the screen house, or if there was a game on, into the pink glowing den. On the mantelpiece, next to a glass pyramid that threw quivering rainbows onto the wall, sat an antique wooden calendar with three windows in its face, and dowels that rolled the linen scrolls inside ahead to the correct weekday, date, and month. Saturday, 2, August. The dowels were pale and smooth, and whenever passing, Alice could not resist twisting one ever so slightly, although she never dared shift Saturday all the way to Sunday, or 2 to 3, or August to September, for fear of not being able to shift them back. Behind the sofa stood a narrow marble console stacked to her elbow's height with books. Many were by prominent writers, others by names she knew as friends. The friend who called her the Kid, for example, had written a book about Auschwitz that Ezra had given a guardedly favorable quote. There were also several galleys, including one of a biography of Arthur Miller, and another of a novel scheduled for publication that fall by Alice's own employer.
a letter from her boss tucked crisply inside. Dear Mr. Blazer, as you'll see in my introduction, Alatoona is a very special novel, not to mention a subtle, respectful, and ultimately triumphant tribute to your influence. I'm not asking for an endorsement, only that you might enjoy the book as much as all of us here at Griffin have done, with surprise and delight at its confidence, its exquisite calibration, its searing wit. Alice shut the galley and took the Auschwitz book out to the porch. Some dinner times an elderly neighbor would drop by, bearing eggs from his hen house along with the local hearsay. Other nights, she and Ezra played cards or read or took a flashlight down to the dock to look up at the stars. One Saturday they walked all the way to the Ram's Head, where a wedding party was still going strong. Men, wielding croquet mallets, chased barefoot bridesmaids around the lawn while a jazz quintet rolled out big band standards in the bar. No, Ezra said firmly when Alice pulled teasingly on his arms. But then the tribal rat-a-tat of sing, sing, sing started up, and a moment later he was percussing the air as if possessed by Lionel Hampton. A bit of finger-snapping here, heel-swiveling there. At one point he even got up on his toes and dared a brief accordioning of the knees. He'd taken Alice's hand and was spinning her through spirograph designs that became larger and looser with each rotation when a woman wearing an upside-down corsage shimmied over to announce, "You know, everyone says you look just like my husband."
"I am your husband," replied Ezra, before proceeding to dip Alice, almost horizontal, and leading her up toward the band.
His bedroom was at the top of the house, where the floors creaked sedately and the gnarled branches of an old oak tree filled the windows with undulating green. In the mornings, as she lay facing him, staring into the radiating brown of his irises and marveling at how unworn they looked, how limpid and alert, even after so many birthdays and wars and marriages and presidents and assassinations and operations and prizes and books, Alice sighed. 97 years they'd lived between them, and the longer it went on, the more she confused his for her own. Outside, the birds gossiped blithely. When the sun reached her face, Alice sat up and tucked a piece of hair behind her ear. Her cheek was still creased with the pillowcase's wrinkles. Solemnly, she touched a finger to her nose, then her chin, then her elbow, the tip of her nose again, and tugged on one ear.
"Bunt," Ezra said hoarsely.
"Yes." Nose, chin, elbow, thigh, earlobe, earlobe, tip of her nose again, three quick claps.
"Steel?"
"Good." Chin, thigh, earlobe, earlobe, elbow, elbow, imaginary visor.
"Hit and run."
When it was his turn, Ezra mirrored what she had done, but in double time and with a deadpan face, and every sequence ended with him pointing at her belly button. Laughing, Alice fell back to the pillow. Ezra gathered her in and kissed her hair.
"Sweetest girl. You are the sweetest girl."
The words were like a hot feather in her ear. In her other ear, with a tone that sounded almost apologetic for having to remind them, his watch beeped noon.
"I follow my course with the precision and security of a sleepwalker. And yet, a sleepwalker's course is anything but precise and secure. It is the uncertain leader who strains to reassure his subjects, and perhaps above all himself, that his objectives are sound and pure. Of only one thing does he feel certain, that he would like to lead. He would like to have power. He would like to be worshipped. He would like to be obeyed. To an extent, these desires are felt by all politicians, or else they would have chosen another, less authoritarian profession. But in some cases, the desires are extreme, born of a compulsion to compensate for past humiliations. An illegitimate father, maybe, or rejection by an academic institution one aspired to attend. There chafes a sense that the world does not understand him, does not appreciate him, and so he must remake it into a world that does. Domination is not merely a fantasy, but also a form of revenge for his status as a failure, a subordinate. An outcast among outcasts, as the New York Times would put it in an obituary of the Führer, running to no fewer than 13,000 words.
In the kitchen stood 3 half bottles of Pinot Noir, a jug of Stolichnaya, and an unopened bottle of Knob Creek. Looking out the window down to the pool where Cleet was skimming impurities off the surface with a long-handled net, Alice uncapped the vodka, tipped it up for a swig, and returned to the porch. But megalomania is not the word. Both suffix and prefix imply an excess, an incongruent sense of one's own influence, delusion. Yet Hitler was not deluded as to the magnitude of his power. He was deluded as to the worthiness of his objectives, yes, but it does not seem possible that he could have overestimated his impact on the history of humanity. When, then, does one man's delusion become the world's reality? Is it every generation's destiny to contend with a dictator's whims? By shrewd and constant application of propaganda, we read in Mein Kampf, heaven can be presented to the people as hell and vice versa, the wretchedest experience as a paradise. But only when the people in question fail in their duty toward vigilance, only when through inaction we are complicit, only when we are sleepwalking ourselves. Another swig. Baby. Baby, where are you? A radio came on. A toilet flushed. Feet crossed the old floorboards and treaded boyishly down the stairs. Alice watched through the porch window as he went over to what looked like an old wooden munitions box, selected an album from the stack inside, and slid it ceremoniously from its sheath. A moment later there was an abrupt, furry blurting sound, followed by the tropical strains of what sounded like a luau. Beyond the blue horizon waits a beautiful day. Goodbye to things that bore me. Joy is waiting for me. Between the verses, he shouted through the window, "Want a drink?" They were in the screen house, licking barbecue sauce from their fingers and watching a canoe glide across the glassy harbor when a figure appeared on the lawn, approaching unsteadily through the dusk.
"Virgil,"
Ezra called out.
"What's the good word?" "Mole got under my tool shed this morning, but I took care of him."
"You took care of him?"
"I took care of him."
The old man coughed, lifted the screen house's door, and stooped warily to enter.
"Listen, Virgil, I've got a favor to ask. You know this lot over the road? The one that goes down to North Cartwright?"
"Yup."
"Do you know who owns it?"
"Lady down in Cape Coral's had it for years."
"What sort of a lady?"
"My age about. Stokes, her name is. Uncle used to live in that little gray clapboard over on Willyet. When he died, his kids sold it to those musical fellows."
"Well, I'd like to get in touch with Miss Stokes if I can, because I've been thinking I'd like to buy that lot before someone else comes along and puts up a car wash."
Virgil nodded, coughing again, his shoulders convulsing and the skin around his liver spots flushing a vivid shade of plum.
"Darling," Ezra said quietly.
Alice nodded and went into the house. When she'd returned and handed Virgil a glass of water, Virgil said,
"Thanks, Samantha."
Later, she and Ezra were in the kitchen playing gin rummy when Alice inquired casually what one should do out here in case of an emergency. Calmly reordering his hand, Ezra replied,
"You mean, what should you do if we're in the middle of doing it and my cigarette lighter goes off?"
"That sort of a thing, yes."
"Call Virgil."
"Ha."
"I'm serious. Virgil's the local EMT."
"The local EMT is 100 years old?"
"He's 79 years old, and he was an ambulance medic in World War II. He was there when Patton said, 'We're training you bastards to kick the butts of the Japanese.' Not that you should know who Patton was. Jin."
He got up to go to the bathroom and came back, looking impressed.
"I'd almost forgotten we had asparagus."
"So there's no hospital on the island?"
"There's a hospital in Greenport, and another one in Southampton, but don't worry, Virgil knows what he's doing. And anyway..."
He flung out a hand.
"Look at me, I'm fine."
After blinking at her thoughtfully for a moment, he brought his hand back in to look at his watch.
"Have you read this?" She held up the Auschwitz book.
Ezra shook his head. It's no good.
What do you mean?
Too much toilet training.
Excuse me?
Hitler was toilet trained too early. Mussolini was left on the pot too long. It's all Freudian speculation that has nothing to do with anything. If you want to learn about the Holocaust, I'll show you what to read.
On Sundays, she brooded. How dreary it would be back in the city. 5 more days of answering phones, hustling blurbs, unjamming staplers. When Ezra went down to the pool for his aqua fitness, Alice stood by the window and watched as he descended to wade back and forth across the sun-dappled shallow end, savoring its resistance. Then the wind picked up, erasing him from view, and the rest of the morning she spent drifting from room to room, picking up books and putting them down again, pouring glasses of lemonade and sitting at the kitchen table to drink them, listening to the bees. The clock over the sink ticked loudly. He came in a little after 2 to find her lying on the sofa, a forearm over her eyes.
Sweetheart, what's wrong?
Nothing, just thinking.
Don't you want to use the pool?
I will in a bit.
What time's your train?
6:11.
What time do you get in?
I should be home by 9:30.
Cleet'll take you to the ferry. As for me...
He looked around as though the room were a mess and he didn't know where to start.
I'm going to stay out here for a while. At least until the end of September. I've got to finish this draft.
Okay.
It's giving me trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I have something for you.
From his shirt pocket, he pulled a sheet of paper with 3 ring holes in it, folded neatly into 4ths. Gita Sereni, Into That Darkness. Primo Levi, Survival in Auschwitz. Hannah Arendt, Eichmann in Jerusalem. Thank you, said Alice.
You're welcome, he said.
He was born in Altmünster, a small town in Austria, on March 26, 1908. His only sister was then 10, his mother still young and pretty, but his father was already an aging man.
He was a night watchman by the time I was born, but all he could ever think or talk about were his days in the Dragoons, one of the Austro-Hungarian Imperial elite regiments. His dragoon uniform, always carefully brushed and pressed, hung in the wardrobe. I was so sick of it I got to hate uniforms. I knew since I was very small, I don't remember exactly when, that my father hadn't really wanted me. I heard them talk. He thought I wasn't really his. He thought my mother, you know. Even so, was he kind to you?
He laughed without mirth.
He was a dragoon. Our lives were run on regimental lines. I was scared to death of him. I remember one day, I was about 4 or 5, and I'd just been given new slippers. It was a cold winter morning. The people next door to us were moving. The moving van had come, a horse-drawn carriage then, of course. The driver had gone into the house to help get the furniture, and there was this wonderful carriage and no one about. I ran out through the snow, new slippers and all. The snow came halfway up my legs, but I didn't care. I climbed up and I sat in the driver's seat, high above the ground. Everything, as far as I could see, was quiet and white and still. Only far in the distance there was a black spot moving in the whiteness of the new snow. I watched it, but I couldn't recognize what it was, until suddenly I realized it was my father coming home. I got down as fast as I could and raced back through the deep snow into the kitchen and hid behind my mother, but he got there almost as fast as I. "Where is the boy?" he asked, and I had to come out. He put me over his knees and leathered me. He had cut his finger some days before and wore a bandage. He thrashed me so hard, his cut opened and blood poured out. I heard my mother scream, "Stop it, you're splashing blood all over the clean walls." Her boss was on the phone, feet on his desk, rolling a piece of scotch tape between his fingers. "What about Blazer? Why don't we publish Ezra Blazer anymore? Hilly wouldn't know literature if it went down on him."
Alice dropped a file into the wire tray outside his door and kneeled to fiddle with the strap on her shoe.
"No, no, I didn't say that. Hilly's full of shit. I said we'd do 1 million for the new book, plus 250 for the backlist,
even though it's unearned by more than the value of your house in fucking Montauk. Does that sound prudent to you? In Germany today, this notion of prominent Jews has not yet been forgotten. While the veterans and other privileged groups are no longer mentioned, the fate of famous Jews is still deplored at the expense of all others. There are more than a few people, especially among the cultural elite, who still publicly regret the fact that Germany sent Einstein packing, without realizing that it was a much greater crime to kill little Hans Kohn from around the corner, even though he was no genius. Caller ID blocked. Hello?
How are you, Mary Alice?
I'm all right. You?
I'm fine. I just wanted to check on you.
Mm-hmm.
You sure you're all right? You sound a little blue.
I am a little blue, but it's nothing. Don't worry. How's your book?
Oh, I don't know. Who knows if it's any good? It's a funny business, this, making things up, describing things. Describing the door someone just walked through. It's brown, the hinges are squeaky, who gives a shit, it's a door.
Endeavors in art require a lot of patience, Alice said finally. She could hear the frogs croaking.
Memory like a steel trap, mealy potatoes.
The camp was between 40 and 50 acres, 600 meters by 400, and was divided into two main sections and four subsections. The upper camp, or Camp 2, included the gas chambers, the installations for the disposal of the corpses, lime pits at first, then huge iron racks for burning, known as roasts, and the barracks for the Totenjuden, the Jewish work groups. One of the barracks was for males, another, later, for females. The men carried and burned the bodies, the 12 girls cooked and washed. The lower camp, or Camp 1, was subdivided into three sections, rigidly separated by barbed wire fences, which, like the outer fences, were interwoven with pine branches for camouflage. The first section contained the unloading ramp and the square, Sortierungsplatz, where the first selections were made, the fake hospital, the lazarette, where the old and sick were shot instead of gassed, the undressing barracks where the victims stripped, left their clothes, had their hair cut off if they were women, and were internally searched for hidden valuables, and finally the road to heaven. This, starting at the exit from the women's and children's undressing barrack, was a path 10 feet wide, with 10-foot fences of barbed wire on each side, again thickly camouflaged with branches, constantly renewed, through which one could neither see out nor in, through which the naked prisoners, in rows of 5, had to run 100 meters up the hill to the baths, the gas chambers, and where, when, as happened frequently, the gassing mechanism broke down, they had to stand awaiting their turn for hours at a time. She was about to send off an email rejecting another novel written in the second person, when her screen went black and the air conditioning sputtered out, leaving behind a dim, primordial silence.
Fuck, said her boss down the hall.
An hour later, she and her colleagues were still bent over stalled paperwork in the dank, growing air, and when he came around scowling and told them all that they could go home, if they could get there. 21 flights down in the lobby, firefighters milled around the sealed elevator bank, eyes raised to the halted dials. On 57th Street, cars jockeyed for a path through the lightless intersections, while the number of pedestrians seemed to have quadrupled since morning. Just north of Columbus Circle, where a self-appointed traffic conductor worked in mirrored sunglasses and shirt sleeves rolled up to his biceps, the line for Mr. Softy ran the length of the block. Longer still were the lines to use the old-fashioned phone booths, earning another stay of execution. People approached them warily, even sheepishly, as if entering confessionals right there on the street. At 68th and 72nd, shuffling throngs pushed onto buses already sagging from the load. At 78th, World of Nuts and Ice Cream was giving cones away. Another block up, the neon harp outside the Dublin House appeared drained of all its color, and heat that was only average began to feel under these mysterious circumstances, extraordinary, seeping and sinister and ineludible, like gas filling a cell. Outside Filene's basement, two women with four bags and five children between them haggled with the driver of a limousine pointed uptown. On the opposite corner, looking more hunchbacked than ever under his 100 coats, the homeless man rested his elbows on a newspaper dispenser and, taking it all in, yawned. At Anna's door, there was no answer. Inside her own apartment, Alice shed her shoes, her blouse, her $300 skirt, poured herself a glass of Luxardo, and slept. When she awoke, it was to a fathomless blackness and the plaintive beeping of her phone. Immediately outside her front door, a fifth flight of stairs led up to the roof, or rather, to a door bearing warning of an alarm that in 2 years she'd never heard go off. Ignoring it now, she ascended through the purple rhomboid of sky, and in the relief of a feeble breeze, walked across the ceiling of her own apartment to stand at the building's prow and look down into the street. A car turning off Amsterdam accelerated west, its headlights pushing through the dark with a new and precious intensity. Candlelight flickered on a fire escape 2 facades away. To the right, beyond the ribbon of river, black as ink, the shore of New Jersey was illuminated as sparsely as if by campfires in the wild. "Cold beer here," a man's voice floated up from Broadway. "Still got some cold beer here. $3. Her phone sounded another dire beep. Without the subway rumbling, without trains hurtling up the Hudson and the hum of air conditioners and refrigerators and laundromats 3 to a block, it was as though a mammoth heartbeat had ceased. Alice sat down and a moment later looked up to confront the stars. They seemed much brighter without the usual competition from below, brighter and more triumphant now, their supremacy in the cosmos reaffirmed. From the direction of the flickering fire escape came a few non-committal chords on a guitar. The beer seller gave up or ran out. The moon, too, looked sharper and more luminous than usual, such that all at once it was no longer Celine's moon, nor Hemingway's, nor Genet's, but Alice's, which she vowed to describe one day as all it really was, the received light of the sun. A fire engine dopplered north. A helicopter changed its direction like a locust shooed by giant fingers slicing through the sky. In her own hand, Alice's phone sounded 3 final exasperated beeps and died. There comes to light the existence of 2 particularly well-differentiated categories among men, the saved and the drowned. Other pairs of opposites, the good and the bad, the wise and the foolish, the cowards and the courageous, the unlucky and the fortunate, are considerably less distinct. They seem less essential, and above all, they allow for more numerous and complex intermediary gradations. This division is much less evident in ordinary life, for there it rarely happens that a man loses himself. A man is normally not alone, and in his rise or fall is tied to the destinies of his neighbors, so that it is exceptional for anyone to acquire unlimited power or to fall by a succession of defeats into utter ruin. Moreover, everyone is normally in possession of such spiritual, physical, and even financial resources that the probabilities of a shipwreck, of total inadequacy in the face of life, are relatively small. And one must take into account a definite cushioning effect exercised both by the law and by the moral sense, which constitutes a self-imposed law. For a country is considered the more civilized, the more the wisdom and efficiency of its laws hinder a weak man from becoming too weak, or a powerful one too powerful. The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2003 has been awarded to the South African writer John Maxwell Coetzee, who, in the committee's words, in innumerable guises, portrays the surprising involvement of the outsider. Alice turned off the radio and went back to bed. Caller ID blocked. Caller ID blocked. Caller ID blocked. Beep. He hung up.
at her door again. Shave and a haircut, two bits. Sighing, Alice picked up her keys and her phone and followed the old woman shuffling eagerly down the hall. The vacuum cleaner stood agape in a large dining room with floor-to-ceiling curios and a fireplace whose delicate molding had not yet been smothered over by their landlord's indiscriminate brush. Behind them stretched a shadowy maze of yet more rooms, one after another all the way to the street, and in the air hung a stale, savory smell. Half a century's worth of latkes and sauerkraut, Alice guessed. On the mantelpiece lay a rent slip, gritting its teeth for $728.69.
"Have you changed your clocks yet, Anna?"
"What?"
"Have you changed your..."
"Caller ID blocked." The words flashed like a heartbeat resuscitated in her hand.
"I'll be right back, Anna, okay?"
He sounded woozy, as if he'd recently woken up from a long nap, and in the background she could hear an aria diminuendoing.
"What are you doing, Mary Alice?"
"I was just helping the old lady on my floor replace the bag in her vacuum cleaner."
"How old?"
"Old. Older than you. And her apartment is bigger than both of ours combined."
"Maybe you should be fucking her."
"Maybe I am."
Back down the hall, Anna was trying to wedge the vacuum's bag out of its recess with a carving fork.
"I'll do it," offered Alice.
"What?"
"I said I'll do it for you."
"Oh, thank you, dear. My granddaughter gave it to me. I don't know what for."
"Have you changed your clocks yet?"
Alice asked, standing.
"What?" "I said, did you remember to change your clocks back this morning?"
Anna's eyes watered.
"My clocks?"
"Daylight savings time," Alice said loudly. Cold from the mail. A Symphony Space flyer on which he'd circled the Kurosawa films he thought she should see, specifically Rashomon, and, if she were able to stay for the double bill, Sanjuro. A Film Forum postcard on which he'd circled the Charlie Chaplin films he thought she would enjoy, The Great Dictator, City Lights, and Modern Times. A MoMA film brochure featuring a photograph of an actress drinking from a coupe glass in Rosenstrasse, and whose hairstyle he suggested she try, should she ever decide to cut her short. His back was bothering him again, so she went to the film forum alone.
"When he twists the lady's nipples with his wrenches?"
And she ran around the room, tightening the air with invisible wrenches.
"And when he salts his prison food with cocaine?"
And she bugged her eyes and put up her dukes.
"And when he roller skates in the department store? And when he runs down the up escalator? And when he gets drunk on the shot-up barrel of rum?"
Flinging out her arms so that an imaginary pair of shirt cuffs flew off, Alice did a sort of slow-motion moonwalk around him in his reading chair and sang, "Sei bella, giu satore, je notre so cafore, je notre si cavore, je la tu la ti la tu wa. Signora, pilasina, voulez-vous le taximeter, eat your tart, tu la tu la tu la tu la."
"Oh, Mary Alice,"
he laughed, wiping an eye and reeling her in to kiss her fingers.
"My darling, funny, cuckoo Mary Alice. I'm afraid that you're going to be very lonely in life."
Now that his book was done, a number of deferred medical matters could be addressed, including a colonoscopy, a prostate screening, and some tests a pulmonologist had recommended to investigate a recent shortness of breath. He didn't have cancer, and a steroid inhaler did away with the wheezing inside an afternoon. But it was also decided, at the urging of a new orthopedic surgeon, that his spinal stenosis be treated with a laminectomy. The surgery was scheduled for late March, and a rotation of private nurses arranged to be on hands for 2 weeks, which stretched into three. One Saturday, shortly after he'd started another novel and gotten back on his feet, he and Alice and Gabriella, the day nurse, went out for a walk.
4 pages, he announced.
"Already?" said Alice. "Wow."
Ezra shrugged.
"I don't know if it's any good."
They sat down to rest on a stoop on 84th Street and watched as a man with a toddler leashed to his wrist paused to frown at his phone.
"You want children, Samantha?"
asked Gabriella, who was Romanian.
"I don't know,"